Hey everyone, it's Alex from Alex and Books, and you're listening to The Reader's Journey, the podcast that takes you on a journey to meet amazing authors, discover brilliant books, and learn valuable lessons along the way. Now, let's get started. Hello everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Reader's Journey podcast. Today we have Sahil Lavingia, author of The Minimalist Entrepreneur. Sahil, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
You're welcome. Thanks so much, Alex, for having me.
So I think a good place to start would be the title of your book. A lot of people know what it means to be a minimalist. A lot of people know what it means to be an entrepreneur. But what exactly is a minimalist entrepreneur?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's kind of taking the two ideas and trying to combine them. And just to recap what those, you know, what those ideas are, like minimalist, right, generally means like back to basics, the, you know, the bare minimum, the essentials, and kind of nothing else, right? Just kind of the simplify, simplify, simplify with the last two simplifies crossed out. That's kind of like the mental image I have in my head when I think minimalism. What do you really need, right? And then entrepreneur obviously is like, you know, someone who starts and runs a business that they own. And I think those two ideas are both really important to me specifically. And I'll kind of tackle them in reverse order. Entrepreneur, I think, is essential because ultimately, in this world that we live in today, I think it's sort of the most guaranteed, and that doesn't mean fast or certain, but it's the most guaranteed way to get to sort of financial freedom, financial independence, the sort of the sovereign individual, like all these sorts of ideas. I think the clearest path that I see is entrepreneurship, right? And to make entrepreneurship as accessible to as many people as possible, I think the idea of minimalism is really important, because what I find is that when I talk to people about building businesses or running a startup or raising money or hiring people or doing payroll or like all of these kind of business, quote unquote, concepts, like the vast majority of people don't empathize with any of those things. They don't associate themselves. They don't identify with any of these things. They think of an entrepreneur as like someone, you know, wearing a suit with a briefcase, right? That's what I thought an entrepreneur was, like almost like its own career path. Like, oh, I'm going to become an entrepreneur, right? Just like you might become a writer, right? But now the beauty of the internet is that you can kind of do all of these things. You can kind of build a portfolio career where you have all of these different experiments that you're trying out. And I even think just the idea of like full-time, quote unquote, employment is like kind of strange. Like, what does full-time mean, right? Like, it's obviously not 24/7. It's like I just like the idea of minimalizing what it means to be an entrepreneur and trying to make it as accessible as possible for anyone to consider themselves as such. Because I think that's really kind of an important step to getting to a world in which everyone feels empowered to be able to start a business, run a business, earn equity, you know, build capital, have compounding wealth, all of these sorts of things that I think are really important. To do all the other stuff that's also important in life, right? To spend time with your family, to get healthy, like all of that stuff becomes a lot easier in a world in which you have a business that you're running. You get to choose who you work with, how much you work, where you work. And hopefully you build up some sort of like, you know, some super linear returns that you can kind of invest in things to save yourself time so you can spend more time doing what you really want to do, right? And so anyway, that was kind of a long-winded answer, but that's kind of like the reason behind the title. And it kind of alludes a little bit to kind of the 4-hour work week mentality in terms of like, you know, what do you actually need to do? And let's just be kind of clear about that. So I kind of think of this as like, you know, kind of an extension almost of that, right? You know, post COVID, you know, post remote work, like a lot of these things have really been proven to be true. And so, you know, no code, creator economy, like how does all of these new ideas that have happened in the last, you know, Stripe, like that these sort of building a business today is very different. It's actually a lot easier today than it was 10 years ago. And 10 years from now, by the way, it's going to be even easier, right? Just trying to get all those ideas across in 3 words. And that was the best that we came up with. So.
Yeah, and I think of this book very similar to your company Gumroad, where Gumroad is really ahead of the curve, you know, going fully remote, working like part-time, very open, building public. And this book kind of gives that framework of like business and no longer work 40 hours a week in office. It's build something small, you know, find the community, you know, become profitable early on and scale from there. And it's very interesting just to see like this new form of business that's emerging. And I think you're really like ahead of the curve here with your book.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because you know, I agreed to do the book with Penguin in 2019. They had read Reflecting on My Failure to Build a $1 billion Company, an essay that I wrote on Medium, and about kind of detailing the history of Gumroad. And initially in 2019, the book was like, you know, basically like, what happened to Gumroad and, you know, what are my takeaways from that, right? And that's not too different from what happened, what the book ended up being in a broad abstract sense. But then that was like pre-COVID, right? And one of the really interesting things that happened in sort of March of last year was like everybody was kind of like, what do we do? Like, do what happened to the offices? Like, basically kind of like everyone was having a quarter life or midlife crisis, right? And I literally Gumroad, we didn't do anything different. We were already remote. We were already kind of in this async culture. Literally, like, we had our COVID kind of midlife crisis in 2015 when we failed to raise the Series B of venture capital. And we made all these decisions then. And that really kind of like was evidence to me that you know, this book should exist. And I was kind of glad that I was in the process of writing it, even though like I had to kind of rewrite a lot of the book because COVID kind of changed things so significantly. It was like and that's a lot of what this book is about. It's like we or what have you, like we kind of did these things, you know, based on first principles for what made sense for us as a company. And now it feels like the world is kind of catching up or what have you. And like, boom, like I have a book like that, you know, hopefully addresses some of these ideas. Like, how do you move to remote work? Like, why is that so important? How do you talk to employees? How do you hire? Like, how do you do some of those sorts of things? And yeah, you're right. Like, it's starting small, I think, is essential, right? Like, I think one of the big problems that I find is that people have like a very high bar for like what step one is, right? They're like, oh, step one of being a writer is writing a book. And it's like, well, that's tough. Like, maybe start with a blog post, right? Or like, step one is like raising a $1 million, you know, seed round or getting into Y Combinator. And it's like, no. Like, step one is like, you know, buying a domain and like having a website, you know, like that's, and like the more that you can, again, minimalize like what it takes to start this journey as an entrepreneur, the more people will hopefully actually make that step, right? Because most people will not, you know, quit their jobs, move to San Francisco, raise venture capital, you know, maybe somewhere in there go to Stanford, right? Like the common path, like 10, 15 years ago, it's just not going to be followed by the vast majority of people, right? And so what does that path look like without gatekeepers, without VC, without a degree, without an office in San Francisco? Like, what is that path? I'm just super, super excited about it. It's kind of funny because Gumroad, like, it is very, when I explain Gumroad to people, it kind of, they're like, that's it, you know, like 11 or 12 million in, you know, annualized revenue. And we have zero full-time employees. We're, you know, 48 plus part-time people, no office. And really Gumroad is just like a website. GitHub hosts the code. We use Slack and Notion for kind of our discussions and maybe a couple other internal tools for, you know, deploy pipeline stuff or what have you. We have Stripe to process payments. We use PayPal for some stuff and we pay taxes, you know, every year. Right. And like, that's the business. Like, that's Gumroad in a box, you know? You know, it could be $100 million a year and be roughly that, right? Like a few more instances on Amazon, right? Like it wouldn't fundamentally change. And that's like the power of software, is that it scales beyond your time, which is kind of a key concept here, right? It's like, how do you move past charging for your time, right? That's kind of like the first, one of the first steps of kind of scaling yourself. Yeah.
So you just covered, you know, a ton of topics right there. I think one beautiful thing you mentioned is that you could start small when you're starting a business. Like Gumroad, I believe you started it because you needed to sell like a pencil icon, and that's what led to this incredible business. And it's like, you only had to do this tiny thing, but it's, you know, that's the truth about every giant business. It's like, it all starts small. And wasn't that true for Gumroad as well?
100%. Yeah. Gumroad initially was a Friday night. I designed this icon, this pencil in Photoshop, and I was like, it took me 4 hours, and I was like, I should sell this for $1, you know, 4 hours for $1. I mean, like, that's worth the math for me. And I had an audience on Twitter, on Dribbble, like, and there was no way for me to do it. And it was in the book, I call them like toe stub moments, where I like wanted to do something and I was like, ow, I can't, like, kind of shocking. And then, yeah, luckily I had a community. I had kind of trained myself through these other kind of small experiments to be like, I cannot just be like, oh, that's annoying, I'll just move on with my life and never sell that pencil icon, which is a kind of what I'm sure many people have encountered this problem before and decided to do. It was like, oh, I have a weekend, I have nothing to do. I can build a little mini app, you know, and that source code is open, by the way. So anyone can Google Gumroad V1 and find like that weekend, the commit history literally from like that weekend is still there. And it's ugly, you know, it's a terrible code. It's one Python file, like literally one file for basically the entire application, tons of copy paste, you know, not optimized, like, but most important, it worked, right? It did the job. I think starting small, thinking of these things like side projects instead of companies or toys instead of apps, like is the lower, the tinier you can make that, the better. And James Clear, you know, Atomic Habits is a great book. And that has a similar idea, right? Which is atomic habits. Habits are made of these tiny, tiny, tiny atoms of behavior change, of identity change. And in that way, this is very similar, which is if you want to be an entrepreneur, if you want to start a business, like you just figure out how can you take this one step, break it up into two steps? How can you take those two steps, break it up into four steps? How can you take those four steps, break it up into eight steps? And then once you have 10,000 steps, what's the first step? You know, and what is that? And like, my guess is you can do it, right? Like if you know you want to start a business, you know what the name is, go buy the domain, go create the Twitter account, go create an Instagram, like just start moving. Right. Like in physics, like rolling friction, I believe it's called, is like much more, you know, much less powerful than sliding friction or whatever. Right. Basically, I don't know exactly the terms anymore, but when something's at rest, it's much more hard. It's harder. It takes more energy to move. Right. But once something is moving, even just a little bit, it's a very different, you know, the rolling coefficient or whatever, like it's very different. The sliding coefficient, like, it's way cheaper, way faster, right? And so it's kind of similar. If you can start moving just a little bit, like, you know, the next step is going to be a lot easier, right?
Yeah, totally. So Sahil, yeah, I see your book as kind of like a framework or like a guidebook to like starting a minimalist business. And one important part you just mentioned is like starting as small as possible. And another great tip you have is to actually be a creator first before you be an entrepreneur. So why do you recommend that path?
Yeah. Creator first, entrepreneur second is definitely kind of a theme. And it came out of just what I observed at Gumroad, which was I saw literally thousands of people that I would identify as entrepreneurs, as business owners, who never would have considered themselves such. They're like, oh, I'm not an entrepreneur. I make a couple hundred thousand dollars a year selling eBooks. Like that's not, you know, I'm not an entrepreneur. And I'm like, what? You make more than some people that do call themselves, like, you know, like, it was just kind of funny. And what I noticed was to be a creator, you have to learn a lot of skills, right? It's a sort of a multifaceted sort of skill set. You have to learn how to write, communicate, market, maybe design, you know, edit video or audio. Like there's all of these things you have to learn, and literally basically everything you need to be an entrepreneur, you kind of have to learn to just be a creator. But for some reason, creator, you know, like just like I mentioned before, like people don't really identify with the word entrepreneur. They really identify with the word creator, right? You look at all the surveys of like, oh, 70% of kids want to be YouTubers or what have you, right? Which we'll see if that actually happens. But you know, they're clearly being pulled to that for a variety of reasons, right? So if I can use that as almost like the Trojan horse, right? Of like, hey, become a creator. Learn all these skills and then apply them, make money, do all that, build an audience, et cetera. You know, you will be far more prepared to be an entrepreneur. And actually, like you may have already become one without you realizing it. And I think that's sort of really, really important. Like it's kind of like the difference between like writer and author, right? Like everyone's a writer, not everyone considers themselves an author, right? An author is some, you know, you have to have a published book or whatever, like that feels to be. And so I just like, you know, creator, to me, creator is just entrepreneur, right? It's just the same kind of word, even. Maybe it's just shorter. You know, we were tired of saying entrepreneur, spelling it out or something. But it's really kind of the same. And I see it, you know, they're both CEOs. They both run a brand and built that brand from scratch, have an audience, are selling some product to them. So like a lot of it is the same. But yeah, I find it to be like incredibly compelling to people when I say, hey, you know, you should be a creator. And everyone's like, yeah, I want to be a creator. You know, like, so I'm like, okay, cool. Like, if that's what you want to do, like, great. Like, let's start there. You know, and then once you feel like, you know, you have a solid base, then we can move on to step two. Right. So that's kind of why I kind of came up with that kind of like create first, kind of entrepreneur second.
Yeah. That's such a great way of putting it. One is kind of like a rebranding, like kind of entrepreneur is kind of like, you know, it's been overused or like too many people say, or still has that business, that old school business context. But if you say creator, it's like futuristic. It's like, you know, you create for a living. And like you said, it's kind of like a Trojan horse. It's like something in the skies. And also just sounds a lot more fun to be a creator than to be like entrepreneur in a sense. So that's a really great way of putting it.
Thank you. Yeah. And words matter. You know, like what I've noticed is like a lot of people want, like one of the hardest things to do is to get everyone to agree on something, right? Like that's one of the hard things to do about any movement. You know, you have to kind of rally the troops somehow and get millions of people to decide this is the path forward. That's really, really, really hard. And you see this with like, you know, crypto, I think had a hard time until NFTs and Web3. And now everyone's kind of like, oh, this is the term that everyone's kind of agreed upon, right? And it feels like it matters because it aligns everyone on kind of a common sort of mission that everyone is kind of getting. It's more clear, right? It's like, oh yeah, cool. If I want to be part of the Web3 movement, like here's a framework in order for me to do that. And creator, I think, does it a very similar way, which we've kind of taken all of these ideas around social media, around user generated content, you know, and said, okay, what do we call this set of activities? So I, you know, Gumroad was the third company that I know to ever use the word creator to talk about our users. It was, and I can tell you kind of the history because I was there, trying to figure out like, what do we call our users? Like, we literally didn't know because there were writers, there were authors, there were comedians, there were filmmakers or photographers. There was no word really to describe them. And what we found was, YouTube called them creators. They were the first company, I believe. And Kickstarter was the other company that we found that called their users creators. And it kind of makes sense, like, you know, in those two contexts. And we were the third. We were the first, and the first sort of, you know, where our primary function was just to help creators sell digital content, which now has kind of become more popular, which is great. But yeah, it was literally because of, like, on our homepage, it used to show like, you know, we are for writers, filmmakers, photographers, you know, all of these things. And it was kind of a cool design or whatever. But now there's a word and you can just say creator. And everyone knows what that means roughly, right? Which is you create content for an audience on a variety of social media platforms. And then you might monetize via, you know, either a SaaS product or digital content or premium membership or community or one of these, you know, or, you know, advertising sponsors, et cetera. Right. Like, and so that, yeah, it's great. Cause it's like, cool, creator, got it, you know, move on. Whereas, yeah, 10 years ago, it was not the case. I said, you know, when we started using creators, people would ask us all the time, like, what is that? What's the difference between a creator and a creative or a creator and an artist? You know, like what, like, and now no one asks that anymore, which is nice.
Yeah. Now everyone seems like, oh, we're in a creative economy and that's just like socially accepted as like the stage we're all in. And so we have, you know, be a creator before being an entrepreneur, you know, start small. And a big part of your book is also like either join a community, being part of a community, or even starting your own community. Can you kind of dive into like why community is such an important role in like building a business today?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, first off, I think building a business is just hard and it's lonely, right? And it's always going to be some degree of lonely, right? Because there are certain things that only you as the founder, CEO of the company are going to be able to do. And that's great. That's kind of the job that you're signing up for. But it is tough. And I think having a community, ideally multiple communities that you are a part of in a way that you really are vulnerable and you're sharing like a slice of yourself, like, I think will just make that journey easier for you. Right. It's kind of like, you know, if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together sort of thing. Right. Like want to kind of do things together as a group and succeed together and fail together, et cetera. Right. I think that's important. And so that's kind of like the sort of more like high level reason, right. It's just like, it's social. It gives you some peer pressure, some collaborative competition, et cetera. Right. It's really helpful in those sorts of ways. But even in the business context, purely strategically, it makes a lot of sense, I think, because the hardest thing about, you know, I think once you've built the product and you have something you want to sell, like a lot of what people run into is like, who do I sell to? Right. How do I, you know, where do I find my customers? And it's like, well, you should have done that before. Like, you should kind of have known that. Like, imagine like I wrote this book and I'm like, okay, who should I find? You know, it's like, no, I kind of knew who I was, you know, writing to, et cetera. And yeah, so I think starting with community really helps with that, where it really helps you start doing a lot of the learning and talking and building those relationships and building real trust, not fake trust. Like, oh, I'm going to sell a business to these people, so I need to like meet all of them, you know, not like that kind of trust, but really building real relationships with people. And this is not a fast process, right? Like you might read chapter one, be like, start with community. Cool. Like, see you in 2 years. Right. Like that's, again, this is like not a get rich quick sort of book. It's kind of a get rich slow and methodically book. Right. But yeah, I think this sort of, and I remember right when I was writing the chapter about sales, sell to 100 customers, like it was the hardest thing to get anyone to like want to get interviewed for. Like, no one wanted to talk about sales. And I think it was because like people just have this very negative idea of what sales is, which is like kind of the used car salesman, right? And the reason we don't like that is because there's kind of a lot of information asymmetry. You've never met this person before. They're going to sell you a car and then never see you again. You're not going to buy another car for a while. So like, they don't have like the right incentives, and it just creates this like less than ideal relationship, right? You don't really trust the car salesman. You're actually told to kind of verify everything that they say, right? And that's just what it is. But I think if you start with community, then it's unlikely that you're going to do that, right? You're not going to, if you have a relationship, you've been in the part of this group of people for a long time, you're friends with them, you're probably not going to sell them a crappy product, right? You're actually going to be too scared. What I find is you're going to be too afraid of trying to involve this community in your business, because you don't feel like you've done a good enough job yet. And that's actually becomes, and which by the way, is a far better problem to have, right? Can help you work through that. But saying, hey, I built this product, I don't know who my first customer is going to be, like that is a very difficult spot to be in, right? It's not easy to go from zero to one. But if you have hundreds, if not thousands of people who know who you are, who've already, by the way, received value from you, right? And sometimes like they'll even have asked you like, hey, can I, like, do you have money? Like, do you need, like, do you have a book? Like, how do I support you? What, you know, like, I mean, I get DMs like this all the time. That's like, hey, do you know, and like, it's surprising. Like, there have been people who like, you know, have read the book and been like, there's no way. Like, there's no, you're literally just telling me to like contribute value for free and never ask for money. And then like 2 or 3 months later, it's like, hey dude, like I did the thing that you said. And like, here's a screenshot of someone that just DM me randomly saying, hey, you have a course that I can buy, you know? And I'm like, this happens because these people are here. They don't join communities just for fun. Like they're there for a reason. You know, all human behavior is problem solving, right? Like they're there for something. There's some job to be done, as Clayton Christensen says, or said, like they're there to learn a skill or make more money or meet people or get fit or whatever it is. And if you're helping them do that, then like there's probably a business there, right? And so, yeah, I think it's a really helpful framework to start with community. And again, it feels, you know, one thing I try to push back on a little bit is this obsession with follower numbers and social media engagement and going viral, right? So, oh, the way, and these are great things to do eventually, I think, right? But not where you want to start, right? Because you can't go to create a Twitter account and then have an amazing tweet storm and it's going to go viral. Like, that's just not going to happen. What happens is you build relationships one by one, literally in the beginning, you build an audience that way. And then, you know, the kind of social media algorithm will do its magic and you will kind of grow in some sort of compounding way. But that's great to go from, you know, 100 to a million or something like that, right? But to go from zero to 100, no. Like, I'm sorry, but like Twitter, YouTube, maybe TikTok, I guess nowadays people say that's possible. But, you know, it's just, to me, it's like you're betting on, you know, an algorithm liking you, which is, you know, a lot of this book is about not relying on external parties, not relying on VCs, not relying on office, like not relying on degrees, universities, like not relying on, you know, capital, like any, basically, can we just get rid of all the excuses here, right? Like, what excuses do you have Okay, I need $1 million. Well, like, no, you don't. Let's get rid of that, right? Let's pick a business that is, you know, can meet you where you are, right? It's like, oh, I don't have customers. Like, well, okay, don't worry about customers. Just like build relationships, help people, you know? And it's like, if you can't help people, then I don't, like, maybe you shouldn't start a business yet, right? Like, what, like, first help people one by one. And then what is a business? A business is kind of just like the productized version of what you were already doing, right? And not all businesses, but certainly a business. And you can always see the other thing is a lot of people, I think, gets really stuck on their first business idea. They're like, no, I can't build that business because it's not my life's work. It's not what I, and it's like, that's fine. it's not like I, you know, this book comes out and it's like, I cannot write another book. Like, I'm done. Like, this is it, right? No, I can do whatever I want. I mean, you know, it's totally fine. There's nothing, you know, holding me to my past self, right? And so, but I think a lot of people get stuck on that, right? And it's like, no, just literally start a business. Like, that's, you know, it doesn't matter what it is, because you will learn the skills you need to learn. And you will have better business ideas literally as soon as you start your business, right? Like, a lot of people think that they need a better idea to get started. But what I found in practice is you don't need a better idea to get started. What you need to do is you need to get started. And then you will have better ideas over time, because you will be in the environment and sort of the mind state to have ideas, which is you're trying to solve problems that are in front of you, and you're having a harder time than you thought you would, because it turns out like the tooling still sucks, right? You know, the picks aren't sharp enough, you know, and you can make better ones. And that's how like the vast majority of business ideas come about, I believe, is that people have problems and they want to solve them. And a great way to have problems is to start a business, because starting a business is still, you know, quite a painful process, even in, you know, the US, where, you know, people would say it's pretty easy. It's still annoying. There's still parts like get a bank account, like fun, you know, it's not fun. I have to go to FedEx later today to like ship some forms. For, like, I literally still, like, this is 2020, October 2020. I'm still 21. I'm still notarizing documents, going to a, you know, like I think one thing, you know, when you're in tech or in startups and you're excited about this stuff and you're on Twitter, et cetera, like, you think that the whole world is here and you're like, oh, I'm super late. Every problem's been solved. Like, everyone has a huge audience. Like, when am I here? You're like, what's left for me? Right. It's like the gold rush. It's over. It's like, believe me, like I literally still teach people about Slack, you know, like literally this happened a week ago where I was like, hey, I'm working with Penguin on this book. Guess what? Penguin Random House doesn't use Slack. You know, they publish these books. But yeah, you know, and this is another thing I learned about the creator economy is like, you talk to a lot of creators at Gumroad. We realize this, like, wow, like a lot of these people are not technical at all. They're not. They're filmmakers. They're incredibly skilled at that hard skill. But if you said, hey, you know, start a blog, they're like, I don't know how to do that. Like, that's too daunting. And it's like, well, you can just literally Google like how to start a blog, like just like how you probably learned filmmaking. You know, but I think that there's kind of a lot of imposter syndrome or what have you. It's scary. It's uncomfortable. So yeah, that's some of my observations.
Yeah. Well, you just covered a lot of great points there. So I just want to like recap a little bit. One is like anything you want to learn is like available on the internet and it's most likely free. So you can just find it if you search for it. Two is like community is probably one of the most important assets you could have. And there's no real way to like hack it. Like I know this, I've been running Alex Books for almost 5 years now. And people always ask, how do you get to like this many thousand followers? And the truth that they don't want to hear is that you have to show up every day. You want to respond to people. You have to answer your DMs. And although the longer it takes for you to build this community, the stronger it'll be and the longer it'll be around. Like I've gone viral lots of times, but it's like that virality expires and like it doesn't build like a strong relationship with people, just like in real life. If you meet someone for a day, even if they're a great person, they're not going to be automatically your best friend. It's like you have to see them like every week or every month to build like that strong relationship. I think people undervalue how hard it is to build a community, but also how valuable all that work will pay off in the future. So it's just really great to read in your book that you do want to build a community or at least join a community to like, just, you know, there's so many benefits to it, especially if you're starting a business.
Yeah. I would say one last thing I would add is that it really highlights how all of life is these kind of incremental atomic one at a time, one by one sort of steps, right? Like nothing goes from zero to two. Everything kind of goes through that intermediary step and audience building is like that, where a lot of people see, oh wow, you have 50,000 followers or 170,000 followers, and like, that's crazy, you must have had all of this growth in like a single day. And it's like, no, literally, it's like every day, you know, a little bit, right? And that number grows. And like, even when I announced the book on Twitter, I said, DM me for the intro and first chapter. And I probably DM'd literally at this point, like 3,000 or 4,000 people, right? And I still do, like, and it's like funny, but like people, someone asked me, they're like, how do you have the time to do this when you have 200 and whatever, 40,000 followers? Like, there's no way. Like, and I'm like, no, you've reversed. I have 240,000 followers because I do stupid things like this. Like, that to you seem stupid. They don't seem like they make sense. But 3,000 to 4,000, like, imagine if half of those turn into book buys or readers or YouTuber, you know, subscribers or followers or whatever. Like, that's literally doubt. I mean, that's already in the thousands, right? And I think communities, it really just reminds me of that. Like, if this book sells like thousands of copies or millions or whatever, like, it doesn't happen in one swoop. It happens literally every single person on their own decided to do it, right? And so I just really, you know, it does get easier to kind of say, oh, I'm not going to do that stuff. I can just tweet and like, boom, like, you know, thousands of people will see it and I can move on with my day. But I love community because it just reminds me that like, look, yes, you can do that. But ultimately, a lot of the really important parts of running a business, scaling, starting again from, you know, like all of these things, like are these kind of like micro interactions where you just have them. And yeah, you're right. There's just no shortcuts, right? Like, everyone wants to hear that you have some hack. And it's like, I'm going to learn what the hack was. And it's like, sorry, you won't. Because it turns out if there was a hack, there probably are some hacks. And those hacks have just been integrated into the way that you just start, right? Like, starting a Twitter account might have been a hack like 10 years ago. But like, it's now sort of commoditized or democratized or what have you. Like, if the, you know, the hacks don't really exist because they, you know, the internet is a very efficient market, right? Like, you know, there are some secrets, you know, but like, you know, I won't deny that completely, but like, it's unlikely that, you know, there's like, you're one YouTube video away from starting a business, right? Like, or one Twitter scroll away from reading a book, right? A lot of at least my personal philosophy is like figuring out like what's the most important thing I could be doing, and literally everything else doesn't really matter. I can still do it, but I kind of think of it like I'm either like for writing, for example, writing this book. Literally, I had two buckets of activities: writing the book and everything else. And it doesn't matter how good I am at all of the other things. The only thing that really matters right now is if I'm writing or not, right? I think community, a lot of these things just remind me constantly of that, which is in business, it's like, how do I just help people? And generally, like, helping people often is like a manual one by one process. And over time you can scale it. You can hire people certainly and all of these sorts of things. But it's, you can't get there until you do the hard work of doing this all yourself, you know, for a while. Right.
Right. Yeah. So yeah. As you mentioned, there's no like one giant hack to building community or like really any of this, like, you know, secrets to like building a strong business. But one like small hack that you do and Gumroad does is like build in public, because it kind of works as a marketing tool. It also works to, you know, tell people about what you're doing and also helps strengthen like that community. Could you kind of share like kind of the advantages of building in public and why you first started doing it?
Yeah, honestly, I think I first started in 2008 or 2009 on Twitter. And there are some of my tweets from back in the day where I like committed to building an app in a week, oneweekapp.com, that I'm sure does not exist. Or if it does, probably redirects to a place you don't want to go. So please don't visit it. But you can Google it and there's some, you know, articles or what have you about it. But I was like 17 or 18 or something. And I was like, I just want to build it. Like, and I'd only been doing iPhone app stuff for like, you know, a year or so at that point, or maybe even less than that. But it was about like community. It was like, how do I find people who are like myself? This is like iOS development in 2009, 2010, you know, it was super nascent. You know, there were maybe like less than 1,000 people who could probably like ever built and shipped an iPhone app to the App Store. Like, I needed to find my tribe, find like-minded people. And this is, by the way, how I met this Pinterest CEO, Ben, you know, like I met like a lot of my network, it kind of goes all the way back to that. Yeah, initially it was like finding my tribe. And then the other reason was, or there's three reasons. One, yeah, find my tribe. Two was just, I was going to do it, right? Like, I think some people hope, like they might see my Twitter or like what I'm up to. And they're like, wow, he must just love what he does. And he's super productive and he wakes up early and blah, blah, whatever, like mental image that they have of someone who's productive. At least that's kind of the vision that I had of a lot of these kind of other people when I was a kid. But the truth is, no, what I do is I say, yes, I can do that. I commit, you know, in public. And then it's like, oh, okay. You know, like, I know I'm going to do it. It's like signing up for a half marathon, right? It's like, okay. Like, I guess, you know, I've never run more than 4 miles in my life, but have a half marathon in a month and a half. And guess what? Like, I guarantee a lot of people, many people, maybe even most, do it. They do it. And there's a variety of reasons that it works, but it works, right? And this is the same thing, just applied to like building software. And then the last sort of reason to do it, the third reason, is it gives you a audience and a potential set of customers right when you launch, right away, right? And the truth is, like, even with this business book, frankly, like, there's lots of business books. Like, it's a book launch. It's a new, like, it's not that compelling, right? It's not that interesting. But if I say, hey, I built a new business over the weekend, I live streamed the whole thing. There's 15 hours of it on YouTube where you can go through, if you want, literally all 15 hours of me building a totally new business from scratch using Stripe, like everything, you know, like 0 to 1. That is much more interesting to most people. Why? Because it's different. It's unique. It's real skin in the game. It's risky. I could fail at this you know, like, I'm doing it in public. I could not finish in time, et cetera. It's more exciting, you know, it's just, there's a whole variety of reasons I think that it's more compelling. And that I learned this with Gumroad. Like, how many people care, oh, Gumroad launched a new feature today? I mean, some, right? But not the broad world, right? But if I said, hey, Gumroad failed to raise a Series B, and this is how we reacted to that situation, that is, you know, many people are curious about that. They want to learn. They want to feel seen. They want to know that, like, oh, this journey isn't as simple or as easy as I thought it was based on these TechCrunch headlines or whatnot. Many, many more people are wanting that information versus what feature did Gumroad ship recently, right? Like, and so lean into that. Lean into, what do people care about? They care about other people. They care about stories. They care about struggles. You know, those sorts of things, and use those to your advantage, right? And you can still do all the other stuff, but I think generally, you know, focusing on the vulnerability side of things, like, generally, that's what people really, really want. And it's not easy. It's not easy, right? It's not easy to say, hey, tweet out your revenue numbers in public, or they're obviously, but that's why it works. It works because there aren't a lot of people willing to do that. And you may be surprised if you are one of the few willing to do that, be willing to do that. Like, all, there's tons of people on the other side who want that information. And boom, now you're the one providing it, right? Like, on YouTube, you can go find a video where I walk through my contract with Penguin. And I go through the economics, like the advance, it's $115,000. It's split over 2 or 3 years. Like, these are just, you know, facts of the agreement and of the industry. But it's just, I tried to find a lot of this stuff when I was, and it just wasn't really there. And so, you know, that, who knows, will that sell books or not? It doesn't matter to me really that much. But I just, yeah, I'm constantly trying to teach people, learn myself. And the side effect of it is, like, building hopefully real trust, real relationships with this audience. And it's very, like, low information asymmetry, right? Like, this model wouldn't really work if they were all these things I wasn't proud of, right? Like, building in public doesn't really work if you're building a product that people don't like, right? So you know, it almost, like, forces me too to be, like, better in a sense. It's like, okay, well, I need to fight for an agreement with Penguin that makes me look good. Or, you know, like, I don't think that should totally inform the way that you live or anything like that. But I do think it's a helpful sort of heuristic for me, is like, if someone was watching over my shoulder, would I still be comfortable doing what I'm doing? And a great way to gut check that is to share what you're doing with the world. And it's like, okay, you know, Gumroad, people generally like as a company, right? Like, would it have worked if we were, like, you know, I don't know, doing, like, you know, helping like the US military, like, you know, with drone strikes? Like, probably not. Like, the Gumroad crowdfunding round probably would have been received slightly differently, right? Not to have a position on that. I'm not, you know, familiar enough to know. But yeah, I think it forces you to kind of, and again, this goes back to community. Like, you have to pick the right community on the other side. They're going to like agree with you on a lot of these things, right? There are certain people that probably, they're like, oh, I want to write a business book for Penguin. Like, click that thing. And they're like, oh my gosh, this person swears. Like, I'm not, you know, and that's fine. Like, you have to find your people, right? Or maybe this, you know, long Penguin contract thing does exist. It just exists in a format that isn't for me. Like, it's like some, you know, super long blog post or newsletter post, you know, somewhere out there, right? But it's not for me because I didn't find it. So here's my contribution to my, you know, part of the internet. So,
Right. Yeah. I think I just want to kind of what you just mentioned, that building in public, like, a big bonus of it is like, you kind of get to see the behind the scenes, and you got to get to know like more of the personality of not just the person, but also like Gumroad as if it was a person. Like, I know you have a whole PowerPoint about like, this is what Gumroad like design looks like. This is like how we talk to customers. And like, I could kind of imagine what Gumroad would be as a person. And also, like you mentioned, I watched that video of you going over your Penguin contract, and I watched a couple of YouTube videos of you kind of discussing with like board members about like where Gumroad is heading. And like, seeing all that, I feel like I already established a relationship with you even before I never met you as a person. So it feels like, you know, that level of trust is already built there. And it's like, you know, it's like we've been friends this whole time while you've been building public, even though we never actually met.
Yeah, it's pretty cool, right? Like, I think it's an amazing feeling. Like, if I was in the same city as you, I know we could hang out and it would be easy, fine. We wouldn't even have to intro each other. Like, it's funny. Someone was like, wow, like, you must be so extroverted. You're sharing so much on the internet and stuff. And I'm like, I'm actually kind of the opposite, where like, I love sharing stuff on the internet because like, I never have, like, we can just get to it. Like, I never say, oh, this is what I'm working on. I don't know. It's like, no, you know what I'm up to. I know what you're up to. Like, let's talk about crypto or whatever, you know, whatever the topic of the day is. Right. And I love that. Like, I love the fact that like, if you're curious about these sorts of things, obviously you're not obligated to, but like, you can read all this stuff about me and then boom, like, we can just skip to like the second or third or fourth conversation we would have had instead of the first one, right? Which I'm happy to do. I'm happy to tell people about Gumroad, like all these sorts of things that I've been up to in my life. But like, I find that like the conversations get a lot more interesting, you know, over time. And if you can kind of skip some of those steps, like, I think it can really help. But yeah, I think just like planting these breadcrumbs, right, around of like, this is who I am and what I believe. And yeah, you can totally, you know, I kind of learned this from the Basecamp guys as well, right? Like, you can almost tell what, like, if they said, hey, we're building an email client, I could almost design it for them. You know, it wouldn't be as good probably, but I know their sort of value system and their opinions and the way they write so well, that I can kind of say, okay, well, they probably care about simplicity and like, you know, like getting rid of a bunch of crap that you don't actually need. And like all, you know, big fonts and big type and like, they probably have a way to not see all the emails because their whole thing is about kind of like minimalism and, you know, only seeing what's important and not letting people take your time without your permission. And, you know, you can almost kind of, and that I think is really powerful, right? Because if you say, hey, I'm building a new startup, we help creators sell stuff on the internet. It's like, okay, you and 50 other people now, right? But if I say, hey, Gumroad's like this weird company, we're all part-time, we don't have an office, we haven't had one in a while, we were VC, but now there's only one of those, you know? So if you're interested in that, if you're interested in this kind of idea that, oh, you don't really like venture capital and you're more interested in this kind of bootstrap for creators by creator, independent movement, you like to sort of Daniel Vassallo, portfolio of small bets, like you like transparency building in public, like there's only one of those, you know? And so you can win on these other dimensions. I actually think my theory, you know, or at least my prediction of what will happen in the next 10 years is this stuff will actually become even more important because the products will be less differentiated because it's going to get easier and easier to build higher and higher quality experiences. Like it will become almost more real. Like, why are you using Gumroad versus this? It might be as simple as like, I want them to succeed more than I want. I associate, you know, I like these people more. Like, this is my tribe, right? Well, like, I mean, this happens, right? Like Uber versus Lyft, right? Like almost has like, people can, to your point, like almost see like Uber is like, you know, it is more like, you know, square edged and like, you know, kind of like a, like a Trump figure in my head, you know, versus like Lyft is kind of like a cool, like hipster biker, you know, like you kind of almost see that play out in your, you can't help it. And that maybe that's just the phenomenal brand marketing teams, right? That really helped refine that. But it like, it matters. And I guarantee you, like, I know they're friends of mine and I can tell you what company they support. Right. I can tell you, I know that they're Lyft riders and they hate Uber or they exclusive, you know, like you just kind of know. It's like owners with their pet dogs or something, right? Like there's some sort of some hint of connection there. So yeah, just kind of, I think it's really, really important and sort of strategically will really, really matter in this world of just like noise overload, you know?
Yeah. And so I was going to ask you, because yeah, building in public is a great strategy for the minimalist entrepreneur. But I feel like some people might be thinking like especially Gumroad, like you guys share your financials, you share your strategies. Like, aren't you giving away too much to your competition? And do you think maybe just your brand protects all that? Or how do you look at that?
Yeah, it's definitely a risk in the sense that, yeah, our competitors could kind of like look at our roadmap and see what we're shipping and these sorts of things. But or yeah, maybe our financials could like reveal, you know, if we're like negotiating with VCs or something like that, we may not want to like be super forthcoming with some of these figures immediately, at least, right? This kind of goes back to like the used car salesman approach, right? Which is like a very salesy, you know, it's kind of like you're using a lot of these kind of sales tactics to optimize for like the short term, which is fine, like no value judgment on that. But yeah, I mean, the way that I justified it to myself was like, look, there are plenty of public companies. They say all of this stuff every quarter. And yeah, it probably is helpful to their competition. I'm sure their competition looks at it and analyzes it. But those are probably not the competitors you need to be worried about, right? The people you need to be worried about are like, for Gumroad, for example, it might be something like, oh, these people are building like a decentralized crypto Web3 version of Gumroad. And that's actually the future. And like none of our competition actually survives this. Like the people, you know, like, I always try to think like slightly larger, right? Even when I was at Pinterest back in the day, people would ask us like, who do you compete with? And we could say, you know, Supply, Delicious, like this kind of old school, like, you know, bookmarking sites basically. But what we said was, no, we compete with Netflix because ultimately like people have time and they want to spend it being entertained and in a sort of pseudo productive way. And, you know, that's who we're really competing against. We're competing against like browser time, right? With Netflix. So, yeah, I think it's really kind of important, to frame who are you really competing against, right? Which is like customer indifference is maybe number one, like no one cares. And then it's like, okay, well, how do we get people to care? And that's probably a much riskier risk to mitigate, you know, via this method. And then honestly, the other thing that I just really, after I wrote reflecting on my failure to build a $1 billion company, actually before I published it, I was like, what company do I really want to run? I don't care how big it is. I don't care how small it is. Like when I hit publish on that piece, it was like, I'm content. I'm happy with Gumroad. I almost like wrote it off. I called it reflecting on as a, you know, kind of a way to signal, like, this is my goodbye, you know, to this chapter. Obviously I hope Gumroad does well and grows and like, I think it will, but you know, I was like, whatever happens, I want to run Gumroad the way I want to run Gumroad and hopefully all the good stuff, you know, numerical quantitative stuff happens as a side effect of that. And that's just what I continuously remind myself of. And sometimes I'll even go back to that essay and be like, oh damn, I'm really glad I wrote this because all these VCs are knocking on my door now asking me if what I would do with a bunch of money. And it's nice to be able to point to this thing and say, look, you go read this. This is my set of values. If you still think we align, like happy to talk, but just know that this is where we're coming from. And we raise this crowdfunding round in public and you can like go consume our board meetings. And like, you're actually going to get more knowledge about Gumroad and my sort of, and the future of Gumroad and the way that I think, then actually I would argue most traditional fundraising processes actually, right? Because there's a way more hours of content than like a 1 hour Zoom or something like that. And by the way, every single time, like they come back and they're like, never mind, not like clearly not a fit. And it's like, awesome. Like you would have, you know, just the last email from you was like asking for an hour long Zoom meeting. Right. So boom, like time saved, right. We don't have to do that anymore. And so I think that's also kind of an important thing is I want people to watch that board meeting and say, hey, I actually don't agree with the way that you run Gumroad. I want to go support Patreon. And it's like, great. You know, I'm glad that you found out now, right? Versus later on. So I think that's also part of it too, is like, I'm trying to really optimize for the long run. And the way to do that is just to be super honest and hope, you know, or not even hope, but just like see what happens. Right. It seems to have worked so far. So I'll keep doing it. And that's, I guess, another important thing in my back pocket is I'm like, well, this worked, right? Like I have data that shows like 9, 10, 11 years in that like a set of decisions that I made that I think a lot of people wouldn't have made the same way seem to be the right set of decisions. And so, you know, I should probably just double down on those, right? Like it would be stupid, I think, at this point to say, actually, I'm going to do everything the way everyone else does because Gumroad is now successful. And imagine if Gumroad doesn't work after that point, then it would be so easy to be like, oh, wow, I really fudged that one, right? So,
yeah. One of the things I love about Gumroad is how like forward looking you are and how you're willing to like try different things. Like, so you guys build in public, you know, you share like your financials online, your strategy, but you also do some other really cool things. Like you mentioned, a lot of your employees just work part time, 20, 30 hours. You're fully remote. Do you see more businesses heading this way? And also like what made you want to kind of pivot and shift to like that kind of strategy? Because I think anyone who works in corporate business today would be like working part time and still paying people like, you know, high wages. It's like, why would you do that? But Gumroad has done that. It's been super successful. And that's also, I think, one of the reasons why people love working there.
Yeah, totally. There's a few reasons. Honestly, the first one was purely existential, which was like the business is going to die. We don't have enough money coming in. And so the only way we can build a team is in this very flexible kind of part-time contractor basis, hiring people abroad to do that. And so it was really initially, and this is like, let's say 2015 was the layoffs and the failure to raise VC and sort of the path to profitability, just really me running it was, you know, took up until probably 2016, 2017. And then 2017 to 2019 was when we, you know, kind of grew, but in this very part-time way. And I was kind of just doing other stuff. I was kind of disconnected. I was like, I need a break. I've spent a lot of my time working like 60 hours a week or whatever on this project. I need a break. I left San Francisco and I was like, I don't want to think about work. I kind of went totally the opposite, right? I was like 4 hour work week. Can we do 2 hour work week, right? It was just like, okay, I'm gonna like just use Notion and Slack and everything, GitHub, and everyone kind of will talk to me through one of these tools, and that allows me to kind of respond on my own time and just kind of, it was really just like, how do I not have to think about this thing for a while I kind of reset and reflect and blah blah blah, and literally just like didn't stop. Like it was just like, oh, this other person wants to work again. Well, this is the way we do it. We pay hourly. You know, it's maybe not what you're looking. And then, like, there was enough people that like, it's like, oh, maybe there we can just continue to do it this way. And we kind of just got to a point. And who knows, like, you know, a year or two, 5 years from now, what Gumroad looks like, it will probably be somewhat this. Maybe we'll add some other stuff as we grow. It just seems to have worked. It seems to have worked really nicely. And I think the way the kind of one liner behind it is, you know, before we were focused on kind of growth at all costs, which is what most startups are probably focused on. Like their number one North Star metric is generally growth, some sort of percentage relative growth generally, because they want to raise more money. And obviously they care about profitability, but it's sort of deferred generally. And in our model, it's like freedom at all costs. Like how do we build a culture? Or I would say maybe now I would say flexibility at all costs. Like how do you build a culture that allows for the flexibility of work that I believe should be present, again, like not full time, right? Like what does full time mean? I just wanted to really lean into that, and it seems to have worked. It seems to be working. There's a lot of stuff to figure out. It gives me like a renewed purpose, because it almost feels like a meta mission of the company now, where we're not only trying to unlock flexible living and work for creators, which is kind of what the creator economy is, right? Is like all these people trying to exit full-time employment, through content creation and things like this. But it's almost more broad than that, which is like, well, even the people who aren't trying to exit like the traditional industries, they also shouldn't be working 40 hours plus a week. Like, how do we get those folks? The current model is just, well, we can write about it. We can build in public. We can show people that this works. Cause I think ultimately people just don't believe it yet. Just like people didn't believe remote work would have worked like in 2019 for most companies, even though there were some examples of it. And now GitLab is, you know, IPO'd with 1,000 employees. They don't even have an office, right? multi-billion dollar, maybe over $10 billion company publicly traded now, right? Like, it's clearly happening. And I do really believe that the next step is no full-time people. Why do I believe that so strongly? Well, it made sense when you had an office, because you can only be in one place at one time. You have one body, right? And so effectively, every company had a monopoly on you because you could only be in one place at one time. And so you had to pick a place and you could only be there. And that was the one job you could have. And the office went away in 2020. And my guess is there's a lot of other things that have went away that we haven't really seen yet. But one of those is, well, you can now work for two companies at the same time, in theory. Right? And there's a kind of jokes or whatever, you know, people will say, oh, I have a friend who works at like Google and Microsoft or whatever, makes double the money, you know, and just like sits in on both meetings or what have you. No idea if that's real or not. But I believe that's the future, right? Because ultimately, like, the sort of macro view I have is that people should get paid for the value they're creating, right? And that means ultimately, even like Gumroad's not perfect at that, because an hourly rate is also not the exact measure of that, right? But if that's the case, then yeah, you know, people, like, why does it matter how much or how little you're working, right? If you generate $1 million in value for Gumroad, you should be able to, in theory, get paid $999,000. I mean, the math still works for us, right? And so I think, and you see this in the economy today, right? Like, it's sort of inequality, like the rich get richer, people who own capital are doing better, everyone else is getting kind of destroyed by inflation, et cetera. And the way I think you fix that is you kind of make companies smaller, you have a lot of them, you allow from that your kind of people to have more leverage. And the best way to do that is to, like, give them the information, right? Everyone at Gumroad knows how much everybody else in the company is making. Like, there's no kind of, there's nothing I know besides maybe like the password to the, you know, to a bank or something like that, right? Like any person who works at the company doesn't know. And I think that just makes it, honestly, just saves me time too. It's like, hey, you want to negotiate for a raise? These are the 8 other people that you're also negotiating on behalf of, which is, you know, great. But like, just so you know, this is like, you know, where I'm coming from. This is the math that I'm doing. And if you can make a compelling case, like, awesome, you're doing my job for me then, right? Which is great. That's my goal here. So I kind of just apply that sort of philosophy, you know, even building in public, like, kind of even internally, you know, because I also kind of want to be almost like non-essential, you know, like, why, what is the most minimalist, you know, entrepreneur you can get is like not even running the company, right? So, I think a lot about how do I kind of get there, and yeah, Gumroad kind of almost serves as this beacon for folks, kind of like Basecamp I think did over the last 15 years around this kind of new way of working, and we'll see how it plays out. I do think that, you know, what you're seeing with crypto, with sort of DAOs and tokens, like, it seems to be kind of a harbinger of like what's going to play out, which is no one is employed, quote unquote, in crypto, right? You just own tokens, which is effectively kind of startup equity or the equivalent of that. That is your incentive to kind of contribute to these communities, et cetera. And like, that to me is, it's a very liquid, it's a very flexible, it's weird, but there are a lot of ideas there that I think will make their way into the kind of traditional economy. And I think I like Gumroad because it allows me to kind of, it feels like I'm living in the middle a little bit, right? Where I'm like, I'm still definitely in like the traditional Web2, fiat, whatever you may call it, world, but I can kind of take some of these ideas and seal them and be like, oh, this idea from crypto is really interesting. How do I apply that to Gumroad today? And it's, you know, one of them is like pseudonymity. Why do I care who you are? Like, if you can do the work, going back to what I said before, if your work is valuable, it shouldn't matter your gender, your age, your degree, your zip code, your country, you know. Obviously, there's still KYC, so we do have to, like, I still have to know where you live, and, you know, we have to pay taxes and pay, you know, things like that still matter, right? But at least, you know, like, let's paint a picture of what, you know, the ideal world, and then we can kind of work within the current regulatory framework to get close to it, and then almost like have a to-do list of like, well, these are the things we will change once they're possible, whenever they happen to be possible, right? But yeah, even at Gumroad, I'm like, yeah, use pseudonyms. Like, you know, no one at the company has last names kind of listed. Obviously, it's not hard to know what my last name is, but I just like the precedent of like, you don't need, going back to minimalism, like, you only bring what you need to bring. And what you need is some way to identify who you are, right? Like, some way to mention you on Slack, but it doesn't have to be your name necessarily. Like, I don't need to know the name that your parents gave you, you know, 35 years ago. Like, that's not relevant necessarily to me, right? So anyway, I like to play with a lot of these ideas. And then honestly, sometimes some people have been like, you know, probably like, why bother? Like, what's, you know, and I'm like, I don't know, it's fun. Like, ultimately, like, this is an important part. Like, it's fun. You know, why do I build in public? Like, well, I enjoy it, you know? So I do think there are reasons to do it. But like, yeah, ultimately, you know, you should find the things that hopefully make strategic sense for you, but also happen to align with something you just kind of enjoy doing and would maybe potentially do anyway, even if there wasn't like a you know, a bucket of money at the on the other side.
Yeah. I really appreciate Gumroad, like, kind of taking the charge and like taking all these new like kind of work policies, because I really think that is the future. Like, I spend a lot of time on Twitter. I'm like, oh wow, the world is changing so much and so futuristic. And then I talk to my friends, like, you know, that aren't on Twitter, and it's like these guys are like 20 years behind. Meanwhile, on Twitter, everyone's like 10 years ahead in the future. So I really do believe that's going to be like the future of work. It just makes so much more sense. It's a lot better way of working. And so I see like Gumroad as like a, you know, really trying new things, and it's like just really cool to see like what you guys are implementing. And
I like to tell the team, like, look, we're on the bleeding edge, which does mean that we might bleed every once in a while, right? Like, there are some costs and risks to operating the way we operate, because like it's just new, you know, there isn't as much precedent. We will make mistakes. You know, some lawyer from Australia might say, hey, the way that you employ people here is not, you know, like, these sorts of things will happen. But kind of going back to the minimalist entrepreneur framework, like, start then learn. Like, it's like, you know, people like, what, you know, people ask a lot, they're like, well, what happens if blank? I'm like, I don't care. Like, we'll figure it out. Like, I don't think the business will die. And, you know, we have some money and we have smart people and we can pay lawyers. Like, we'll get through it, you know? And I really believe in, like, I don't know, like, I have a lot of trust in the system. And I really believe that, like, if you have good intentions, people will help you succeed and make them a possibility. Like, my goal isn't to just say, oh, like, the government's evil and 40 hours a week. Like, no, like, they have reasons for putting those things in place. And there are, you know, the world is different now. And like, as long as we show people what we're trying to do, and we do it incredibly transparently, which hopefully, you know, inspires trust, then we will, that's how we win the argument, right? Is by showing people that this is possible, instead of just saying it, you know, this is the way it should be done, or this is better. No, it's like, look, this is the way we run the business. And like, you know, hopefully we can go public and, you know, do all the things that will, you know, people think successful businesses should do, but this in this weird way, you know, in order to promote this kind of mission. But I do hope as well that like this does become kind of the default kind of future of work, because it feels like too anachronistic, right? 40 hours a week. I mean, it's strange to me. Anything that looked the same pre-internet and post-internet, I'm like, there's something up here. Like, we, you know, in the 30s and 40s, we went to the factory and, you know, commuted and worked there for, you know, whatever, with an hour-long lunch break. Like, all these things, like, don't really make a ton. They didn't make a ton of sense even in 2019, you know. But certainly, you know, remote, you're like, why am I working 9 to 5 at home? Like, that's weird, you know, like. I am excited for kind of like the kind of second, third, fourth order changes that will start to kick in, and hopefully Gumroad can contribute to them.
Yeah, definitely going to be interesting to watch that happen. And so, Sahil, you're one of the people that, you know, I follow on Twitter and love reading your tweets. And another person I follow a lot is Naval. And I know you guys shared a lot of Clubhouse conversations and your friends. Are there one or two lessons you learned from him? Could be about business, could be about life, or like any one or two lessons stick out that, you know, he taught you?
Yeah. Oh, man, a lot. Naval's an awesome, awesome human being. One of them is writing in public. Like, I think people sometimes forget, or at least maybe if they just learned about him on Twitter, like, don't realize that this person has been doing this kind of thing, which is kind of learning and sharing his knowledge in public, you know, pre-Twitter, right? Like pre-Twitter. You know, he had a blog called Venture Hacks. I believe it's still there if you just go to venturehacks.com, which was kind of the predecessor to AngelList. Like, it's kind of funny because it is the minimalist entrepreneur framework, right? He started a blog, he started contributing to a community, teaching what he was learning over time, trying to increase more, you know, information symmetry in these kind of venture capitalist entrepreneur conversations. And then he productized it with AngelList. Like, you know, it's kind of funny how cleanly, so like very much an inspiration, I think, in many ways. And then I think I really, and so that's kind of like the broad kind of career, maybe strategic one. And then I just really like how he doesn't focus on anything that doesn't feel important. Like, it really feels like he's really just focused on what matters to him. And he's just very honest about that, even in ways that might make you uncomfortable. You know, like if I'm like, hey, like, what's up? You know, I probably won't respond. You know, like, he's very kind of focused on, and that's great. And I the word transactional has a negative connotation, but I like the fact that I kind of go into those conversations, get it, wanting something, getting it incredibly quickly, and then moving on with my life, and vice versa. Like, I like that. Like, and I really believe, like, when I talk to founders and when I talk to people who DM me on Twitter, like, my goal is literally to just help you solve whatever problem you're trying to solve at the moment and then move on, because then I can go help somebody else and you can go do what you really, I assume you don't want to just talk to me all day. And just being honest about that, like being honest about just the fact that everyone has like a thing that they want to do. Like, they don't follow me on Twitter because they think I'm a genius. They have some problem. They think that I might be able to help them solve it. And that's like, I don't know. It lowers my ego almost, right? It's like I try to kind of keep that in mind, where like everyone has their own concerns, their own problems, their own stuff that they're obsessed with, and I can help them. But ultimately, it's not about me. It's not about like, hey, I wrote a book and it's awesome and I'm a Penguin published author. But, you know, like, it's not about that. It's about, hey, I wrote a book that I think can help in these ways. And hopefully it does. So I think it's kind of like anti-hype in that way, where it, like, you know, even AngelList, right? Like, now it's the kind of, it's a pretty big, it's pretty important. It's kind of a fundamental pillar of the kind of startup ecosystem. But it's a, you know, 13, 14 year old company. It took a long time to get there. And I don't think Naval's ever said anything like this is, like, he barely even talks about it, right? Like, I'm sure like a good chunk of his audience doesn't even know that like he started AngelList, right? Maybe doesn't even know what AngelList is, but like, I really like that, where I'm like, I really want to focus on my ideas. That's why I love Twitter. I can focus on my ideas. And less so about my resume, my credentials. You know, like, the book doesn't say founder of Gumroad, you know, 11 millionaire, or like whatever. No, like, hopefully you'll get that from reading the book, but it's just the minimalist entrepreneur. This is my name. And really trying to sell, you know, based on what's in front of you, right? The cover and that kind of those ideas themselves. So anyway, that was a lot. Yeah, definitely. He's definitely inspiring. And the other thing that I would say that is kind of a meta observation is that you don't even need mentors in today's world, because you can learn like everything that I've learned from him. Like, none of that was learned by me like grabbing coffee with him, you know, like whatever. Like, it's just, no, I just follow him on Twitter. Like, I've hung out with him a few times in person, whatever. But like, you know, it's just like, you can get a lot of this stuff just listening to him talk on Joe Rogan podcast or whatever. And you'll get a lot of this stuff. And then it kind of is like, oh man, it turns out there are no shortcuts, right? Like, that's like that's always the ultimate lesson I get. It's like, oh yeah, it's just hard work. You know, it takes time and it is high risk and you will likely fail. But like, luckily, it's okay if your business fails. Ultimately, who cares, right? Like, what matters is you get what you want eventually, right? So.
Yeah, it's such a cool time to live in where, yeah, you don't have to be best friends to Naval to like read his tweets, listen to him on his podcast, or read the Almanac of Naval Ravikant. It's like, there's so many ways you could find the mentor today without ever meeting the person. So it's just, you know, a great time to live in. And Sahil, so I know your book will most likely impact like the future generation of like business creators, entrepreneurs. But were there one or two books that you read as a young adult that had like a huge impact on your life, and how did those books change you?
Yeah. Oh my gosh. There's a long list of books that, and I can send you a link because there's a list of 50 or 40 or 50 of them. I feel like were really essential for me. And I'll just pick a couple randomly. One is Moonwalking with Einstein, which was a really important book for me. It's about three different things, but primarily around kind of just like memory and like how memory works and some kind of tactics around increasing your memory. But to me, what was most interesting was this idea that, you know, we live in this world of like, you don't actually need to memorize stuff, right? Because everything is a Google search away. But like, I just like this reminder that no, it like, there are certain things that you want in your brain, right? Like, close as possible. Where you don't want to be, you know, if you have to Google, if it's a Google search away, like it's too far. Like you're not going to be able to use the information as, like, for example, like Steph Curry's not going to go Google for like how to report it from this. Like it has to be innate to your, kind of your being almost, right? And so I really like that. It talks about how like back in the day before libraries were commonplace, et cetera, like people would literally just pick a couple books and memorize them. And just literally just memorize. And so your personality became like three books, right? Like you pick three books, you know, one of them is probably the Bible or the Quran or something, right? And then you pick two others, and that's kind of 80% of your personality. But so I kind of just, I don't know. I like reminding myself of that in this age that like, it is still important to read, to internalize these lessons pretty deeply, to reread over and over again. I'll avoid Beginning of Infinity because I know Naval's talked about that like 50,000 times, but that is a great one. But my version of it would be Ishmael. So Ishmael is it's a fiction book. And I like fiction a lot for these lessons because it feels like I learn more almost because my guard is down when I read fiction, you know, I'm surprised and delighted more often, but also, you know, disappointed as well. Well, with Ishmael, you know, one of the lessons I took away from that, there's kind of this conversation that happens in the book, and basically it's like a gorilla talking to a human or something like that. And the gorilla basically just makes the observation that, you know, genetically we are very, very, very similar. We are 99% similar to an ape or even like a banana, or, you know, like very, very similar. But we are obviously capable of like 100x, 1000x, an infinite amount more creativity, technology, innovation, what have you, observation of the universe, et cetera, than a banana, right? And I really, it just got me really thinking about, oh, we are not done. We are not done. It's so easy to think that we are at the end of history, right? This is the end. Like, and you know, this is kind of like the religious observation, right? Is that like kind of, and I was sort of born and raised Muslim, you know, basically Christian, right? With different words or whatever, but, you know, the vibe that you get is basically like, this was all created for us, right? And you kind of just assume that like humans are kind of the end state of, you know, you don't think, oh, like a billion years from now, we're going to have like six arms, right? Like you kind of think we're kind of done evolutionarily. Ishmael really, like, for whatever reason, really convinced me that like, no, like just like tiny change to monkeys made us humans. Like tiny, you know, sort of genetic, you know, very, as a percentage, very, very small, changed everything. And like, what does that mean? Right. Like it probably doesn't mean that we're just apes with like nicer houses. Obviously you look around, that's not, you know, but like we are probably still underappreciating the future, right? We're still very, very, very early in like the sort of grand arc, the beginning of infinity, as David Deutsch calls it. We are still very, very, we're at the very, you know, there's that hockey stick, right? We're at the very tip. And guess what? We're always at the tip, right? Because as long as we continuously innovate, invent technology, you know, sort of execute on science and research, and like we will continuously learn more stuff, do more things. And, you know, like the kind of example I think David Deutsch uses is like, you know, space factories, right? And it's like, that is a concept that like most people probably never even heard of. But like reading it, it's like, obviously we're going to have space factories in like 20 years. And if we have space factories in 20 years, why can't we have this, you know, in 50 years? And it's like, I don't know. And that always, you know, that always gets me excited because what it means to me is as long as I don't die, like as long as I continue to function, I will be around to see some awesome, awesome, awesome stuff. And that gets me, I don't know. That just makes me feel good. It makes me excited about contributing to that future. Like if I believe climate change was ending the world, I would probably not do as much for the world. Cause like, why would I put in a bunch of time and wake up early and sleep late for the world to end anyway? Right. Like, but if I believe, no, actually like we're early, early, early days, you know, we're in the first 1% of humans who will ever be born or less, then my impact's going to be a lot more, right? The ripple effects, the network effects of what I accomplished today. Most people will never even connect the dots all the way back. Just like I don't connect the dots even more than two or three generations ago. Right. But that's fine because my sort of the value that I'm creating is like incomprehensibly large, right? And all of us, right? Not just me, right? Like broadly, like our generation is just very, very consequential. And of course, like, you know, the beginning of infinity could be wrong. Like we could nuke ourselves tomorrow and boom, right? But like, I don't know, of the views that I like, you know, of the possibilities, I like thinking that we're on the on the kind of the simulation argument one, right? We're on the Elon Musk track. To me, that is more exciting and gets me fired up more than anything else. So anyway, that was really long, but Ishmael and Moonwalking with Einstein are both great books.
Two books I'll definitely have to check out. And it's really interesting how just like yourself and also like Elon Musk, a lot of these like, you know, founders and CEOs, like they've really been influenced by fiction books, where it's like you think it's like sci-fi, but eventually it's going to happen. And that's kind of like an opportunistic way to look at things, like, hey, like eventually everything in these sci-fi books will become reality, and it's only a matter of time before that happens.
Yeah, I mean, it's some of these things are obvious in the sense that they will happen, right? And like they're not even that hard to predict, like in the sense that, like, yes, I think a lot of people probably predicted that once the internet came about, that eventually you'd be able to buy stuff on the internet, right? Like solving that problem is much harder. But yeah, I love reading these books and being like, yeah, like this will, why not? You know, I have zero pessimism around like visiting Mars or going to space. Like, yeah, like, of course, like I have zero doubt. And, you know, the physics are clearly, it's possible, like you're just shooting something up into space. Like, and once it's in space, you can kind of point it anywhere and, you know, it's effectively free almost to get there, right? Like the hard part is getting into space. That's expensive, right? Overcoming gravity. And then you're kind of good for a while until you have to land again, right? Just like flying. But taking off and the landing is the hard part. Like the flying is actually easy. It's like driving, except you can't run into anything, is what a friend told me. But yeah, it's I don't know. I constantly just love being reminded that we are very early. And yeah, just stay alive and things will just improve. I really believe that.
Yeah, totally. Same here. So Sahil, this has been a wonderful conversation. I really enjoyed talking about the Minimalist Entrepreneur. I'm sure listeners did too. Where should they go to kind of learn more about you, you know, find your book, just, you know, come across more of your stuff?
Yeah. I mean, I think Twitter is probably the best jumping off point. My Twitter handle is @SHL. And yeah, from there you can, you know, probably find links to my book or Amazon or Audible or all the places. you know, ultimately, like, I think Google, right? But yeah, Twitter is probably the kind of the best place to look at my stuff, or reflecting on my failure to build a $1 billion company, which is generally my tweet unless I'm have a book coming out soon, is kind of like probably the best long form to kind of get a quick hit of like, okay, this is kind of like who he is, right? And like why the beliefs that we have, I think, are a result of our experiences to a large degree. Like, it's kind of hard to avoid that. And that's a good kind of summary of my experiences and may inform like why my worldview is the way that it is.
Yeah, I really enjoy following you on Twitter, and I highly recommend other people do too. And I just want to say thank you for starting Gumroad, for kind of, you know, leading the future of work, for writing this wonderful book. And of course, thank you so much for coming on the Reader Journey podcast today.
You're very welcome. Thanks so much for having me.
Hey, everyone. I hope you enjoyed this episode of The Reader's Journey. You can learn more about what's covered in today's podcast in the show notes below. If you enjoyed this podcast, the best way you can support it is by subscribing and leaving a positive review. If you're looking for reading tips or book recommendations, head over to alexandbooks.com. If you want to join my reading journey, you can follow me on Instagram and Twitter by searching for Alex and Books. That's all for now. Thank you so much for listening, and I hope to see you soon. Read on, everyone.